The recording that you're about to listen to is a talk from the City Bible Forum. We would appreciate you respecting our copyright by not making copies of this talk or altering the content in any way. We hope that you find the material beneficial. If you would like more information on the City Bible Forum, you can visit us on the web at citybibleforum.org.
Good morning, everyone. Hi. Sorry to interrupt your breakfast and your conversations. My name is Norm Lee, and it's my privilege to introduce my colleague at International Justice Mission, Amber Hawkes. Welcome to the City Bible Forum Legal, and Amber is speaking today about the biblical and other foundations for International Justice Mission and its work around the world. I might just give you a bit of an overview of Amber's background and to give you an understanding of where how she's come to this role as the Chief Executive of International Justice Mission. Amber is the founder and Chief Executive of the Australian Partner Office. She has professional experience in a major national law firm. She's worked for the Office of the Commonwealth Director of Public Prosecutions and has been involved with IJN for a number of years in India and in the United States, and has worked in India directing a legal team fighting cases of slavery in the modern day. Before I ask Amber to come up and speak to us, I'm going to read from a couple of passages from the Bible. You'll see a little handout there on the tables as you came in, or if you don't have one of those, you can pick one up near the jugs of water at the staircase. Amber will be referring to these during the presentation. The first one comes from Isaiah chapter 1, verse 17. Learn to do right, seek justice, defend the oppressed, take up the cause of the fatherless, plead the case of the widow. I should also mention that the logo behind me on the screen, and also on the top left, the International Justice Mission logo, draws the Latin from Isaiah 1, 17. So if you see just above the logo, it's Quirite Judicium Subvenite Oppresso, which translated means seek justice, defend the oppressed. The logo also has on the left side a Bible and the right side of that map the law book, showing the two foundations of the law and the Bible in IJM. And the leaves underneath on the left, it's oak leaves representing strength, on the right, olive representing peace, and then the barbed wire is a symbol for the oppression that strength and peace are seeking to overcome. And so now I'll move on to reading the next passage from Exodus, chapter 3, verses 7 to 12. The Lord said, I have indeed seen the misery of my people in Egypt. I have heard them crying out because of their slave drivers, and I am concerned about their suffering. So I have come down to rescue them from the hand of the Egyptians, and to bring them up out of that land into a good and spacious land, a land flowing with milk and honey, the home of the Canaanites, Hittites, Amorites, Perizzites, Hivites, and Jebusites. And now the cry of the Israelites has reached me, and I have seen the way the Egyptians are oppressing them. So now go, I am sending you to Pharaoh to bring my people, the Israelites, out of Egypt. But Moses said to God, who am I that I should go to Pharaoh and bring the Israelites out of Egypt? And God said, I will be with you, and this will be the sign to you that it is I who have sent you. When you have brought the people out of Egypt, you will worship God on this mountain. So I'd like to now ask Amber to come and speak to us about IJM.
Thank you.
Thanks, everyone. So as Norm says, I do have a background in the law and first began working with IJM in 2006 when I was in India, directing a legal team fighting cases of bonded labour. But before I go into that, a little bit about myself, I think I went into the law because I could at the time, and I think my understanding of why I went into it at the time was quite shallow. And I know that you all are much more learned than I was at that stage that I chose to go into it. But what this work has done for me has really brought together the reason why we do this as Christians, the reason for our work, and the way it fits in with our faith. And I hope to bring a little bit of that to you as I describe our work and the biblical foundations for it as well, and maybe that might resonate with where you're all at as well. So, International Justice Mission. We're a Christian human rights organisation essentially working to protect the poor from slavery, sexual exploitation and other forms of violence. We work currently in 18 communities across the developing world. We work in partnership with local authorities. And what we do is we bring rescue to individual victims, but also restoration. And then we work in partnership with the local authorities to bring criminals to justice. Beyond that, we design programs that provide advocacy, support and resources to strengthen justice systems so that they protect the poor from violence and provide them with a safe future that lasts. So that's the general overview, and you'll get more of a flavour as I speak about what that means on the ground and in reality. So for me, the first time I really witnessed the brutal reality of everyday violence to the poor was in India, when I met many of our clients, like Mariama. She was one of the first people I actually met when I got on the ground there. And she had actually been lured into a brick kiln. Her family was poor because they had suffered drought and they couldn't actually afford to get through the next season. And a business owner had come into the village and had offered an advance and that small loan, basically, and said, "You can just come and work for me. And work for me for a while with your family, with your husband. If you work here, then you can pay it off after a while of work and return to your land." That's what she thought she was getting into. But when she arrived at the brick kiln, she realised that that wasn't the case. There were high walls surrounding it. And soon enough, they were starting to be beaten. They were working 18 hours a day. They were verbally abused. But worse than that, often at the end of the day, she was gang raped by the owner and his sons. And her husband, while that happened to the women in the brick kiln, was actually tied up as he watched them be taken away. That was the reality for Mariama. My colleagues around the world work with clients like Melinda, who's a young girl in the Philippines. And in fact, she was deceived by an Australian guy who was living there into thinking that he'd provide her with a job or take care of her. In fact, what he ended up doing was raping her every other day for 6 months, taking lewd photos of her, and then selling those photos online. Or clients like Charito, who was deceived at 14 years into thinking she could get a decent job in Cebu, but instead ended up at an establishment like this, where she was repeatedly sold to customers and essentially raped for profit that she never saw. These are the clients that we work with, and that's the reality. And unfortunately, there's millions like them around the world. The estimates are currently that there are nearly 30 million slaves in the world today, and there are 2 million children being exploited in the global commercial sex trade. And for us at IJM, the foundational question we ask then is, what does God have to say about all of this? And what does it have to do with us? And to explain that, I'd like to just take us through the Exodus passage today and work from there, because it really contains all of the elements of why we do our work. And I just want to read it again, because we need to let it sink in. The Lord said, in relation to his people, the Israelites that were in slavery at the time, "I have observed the misery of my people who are in Egypt. I have heard their cry on account of their taskmasters. Indeed, I know their suffering. And I have come down to deliver them from the Egyptians and to bring them up out of that land to a good and broad land, a land flowing with milk and honey, to the country of the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Amorites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites. The cry of the Israelites has now come to me. I have also seen how the Egyptians oppress them. So come, I will send you to Pharaoh to bring my people, the Israelites, out of Egypt." But Moses said to God, "Who am I that I should go to Pharaoh and bring the Israelites out of Egypt?" He said, "I will be with you, and this shall be the sign for you that it is I who sent you. When you have brought the people out of Egypt, you shall worship God on this mountain." The first thing we see in that passage is there are people suffering at the hands of a real oppressor. So for us as Christians, injustice shouldn't really be surprising to us. We should be the last people actually surprised that this type of injustice exists in our world, that there are nearly 30 million slaves. We should be surprised. Shouldn't be surprised. It's right there in the second book of the Bible. But how would we define it, and how exactly did it all start? Well, we see in Genesis that the Lord created man to image him, but God is still the creator, and man is still the creature. And man is given good things from God and given power to be a co-creator and live in community, a role to steward well what God has given. And stewarding well actually recognizes God's lordship over all creation. Each individual life, and respects the image of God in each person. But since the fall, what humans have done is we've sinned by falling into the trap of not submitting to God as the only king, and we've sought to be lords over our own life. And what that means is we take control over other people's lives as well, and seek to be lord over their lives. And when that happens, we get injustice. Here we see that these people have been suffering under the oppression of forced labour. They were used ruthlessly by the Egyptians. But it's not actually just a situation about God's people being oppressed. We see this in other situations. For example, Abraham. We know about Abraham. He was actually called the father of the faith. He was one of the holy men of the Bible. But he actually sent Ishmael, his son, out to the desert to die. This is injustice, and it exists all through the Bible. It's the misuse of power to take from others what God has given them, their life, their liberty, their dignity, and the fruits of their love and their labour. This happened since the fall of man, the strong preying on the weak, the powerful preying on the powerless, the wealthy preying on the poor. So we're not surprised by it, and that's what it is. But what does God do? We see in the passage that God sees and hears the suffering of the oppressed. He says, I have heard their cry on account of their taskmasters. Indeed, I know their suffering. The cry of the Israelites has now come to me. I have seen how the Egyptians oppressed them. And the same happened for Hagar and Ishmael. He didn't just see his own people, the chosen ones. He said, the Lord has heard the boy crying. The angel of God called out to Hagar from heaven and said to her, what is the matter, Hagar? Don't be afraid. God has heard the boy crying as he lies there. Lift the boy up, take him by the hand, for I will make him into a great nation. So he hears him too. And he also hears the cries of the millions of oppressed around the world today. Those 30 million slaves. He hears the cry of Mariana. He hears the cry of Charito. He hears the cry of Melinda. And then what? We see from the passage that God wants to rescue the oppressed. His character is one of justice. He says, I have come down to deliver them from the Egyptians, to bring them up out of that land to a good and broad land. This is his character. We see in Psalm 11, 5 and 7, the Lord examines both the righteous and the wicked. He hates everyone who loves violence, for the Lord is righteous and he loves justice. Those who do what is right will see his face. The Lord is a God of justice. But he's not only a God of justice, and he doesn't just hear. He actually shows up and he acts. How does he act? Well, he sends rescue through his son and through his people. Here, in this passage, again, we see that he sends his person, Moses. So come, I will send you to Pharaoh to bring my people, the Israelites, out of Egypt. And we know that the beginning of God's ultimate rescue mission to restore right relationship and wholeness and justice, to restore that shalom, and to bring us back from that fatal error of taking place of God, was to send his son to live the kind of life that we couldn't live. And Jesus actually makes it very clear that he has come to bring redemption and justice in tangible ways, right here, right now, on earth. We see the beginning of his ministry. This is what he says. The Spirit of the Lord is on me because he has anointed me to preach good news to the poor. He has sent me to proclaim freedom for the prisoners and recovery of sight for the blind, to release the oppressed. And the life of Jesus is not just, release from spiritual oppression. He's actually practical. He heals and he restores. In his relationships, we see that he's seeking the reversal of that abuse of power. And now we know that there does remain injustice in the world until he comes again and all the pain and the crying is gone. But what happens now? Well, he works through his people, through us, And in fact, he commands us to do justice. And this is IJM's foundational call and our passage, which we base our work on. God says to his people, learn to do good, seek justice, rescue the oppressed, defend the orphan, plead for the widow. As imitators of Christ, as followers of Christ, we should take inspiration and hope from Christ's example. We follow him into this work. We love our neighbour as ourselves. What would you want someone to do if your daughter, or if your wife, or if your sister, or if your mother was enslaved in a brick kiln? Or if it was you? That's why we at IJM work in partnership with local authorities to ensure the enforcement of laws that already exist in these countries to protect the poor from violence. We work to bring rescue and restoration, to bring criminals to justice, and to strengthen justice systems. And we see that God shows up in Acts. In the Exodus passage, he brings the oppressed to a good and a broad land. And that's also what he's done through his people for Mariama. With IJM, we partnered with local authorities. We gathered evidence. We brought them to the person with the power to act. We went in, and she was rescued from that situation. And she's now restored, and she's living a life of freedom. In Melinda's case, we worked with the Philippine National Police to say, here are your laws. Here is the evidence of what is being done to Melinda. Come, act, enforce them. And then as we go with those authorities, we mentor them along the way, teaching best practices to how to implement these operations and how to secure justice. And Melinda was brought out from that situation. In Chirito's case, Chirito is now free. She's gone through an amazing aftercare program. She didn't even finish primary school, but she's now in went through high school, and she's now studying a degree in social work. She's mentored other sex trafficking survivors. And more than that, she bravely testified in the cases against her perpetrator. And after 6 long years of trial, in which IJM lawyers and social workers walked with her and walked through the local prosecutors, the perpetrator was convicted, and she was sentenced to 20 years in prison. And this is what Chirito said. This conviction, this is an answer to my prayers. Because all this time, I've been praying, God, please grant me justice. And she also thanked the IJM attorneys and social workers, saying, without your work and prayers, I would not have been able to obtain this. As lawyers, we are actually in the business of doing justice, which is good news. It might not actually feel like it at times, especially if we're here doing our work. But it is possible to use this training for real good, and we work in a justice system to make that happen. It can actually sometimes feel risky to step out. But we know from this passage, again, as with many others, that as we step out, God goes with us, and he actually provides for us. That's the trip to read, by the way, now. Moses said, who am I that I should go to Pharaoh and bring the Israelites out of Egypt? But God said, I will be with you. And we know he was with Moses every step of the way. It took courage and it took trust on Moses' part. But we know that God was the one that brought the Israelites out of Egypt. And as we do our work at IJM, we know that God is with us. We actually have a prayer partner program. We have thousands of prayer partners around the world who are praying for the individual needs of our cases weekly. But better than that, after they pray, they come the next week and you can look up that prayer partner update for the next month and you can see that your prayers worked. We prayed a month ago for the release of 300 people from a group. And this month, we've seen that God has done that work. So we know that God is with us. And he is with you. He is with you as you step out and take risks to do justice. And I guess I'd just like to finish on this final point that I find really, for me, inspirational and hopeful. And that's back to the passage, that final point, the last verse. That doing justice returns to God as worship. He says, I will be with you, and this will be the sign for you that it is I who sent you. When you have brought the people out of Egypt, you shall worship God on this mountain. And we see in Isaiah that no platitudes, no praises, no songs, no actions. There's nothing that we can actually offer to God in worship if, in fact, we're not doing justice. It doesn't please him. We're to offer ourselves as living sacrifices and to do justice. And I just want to leave you with this passage that I find so encouraging. And I hope you all do too. It hangs above my desk and I read it every day. He says to the Israelites that he's not quite happy with for the way that they have been engaging in this ritual, these ritual acts of worship. He says, they say to him, why do we fast but you do not see? Why humble ourselves but you do not notice? Look, he says, you serve your own interest on your fast day and you oppress all your workers. You fast only to quarrel and to fight and to strike with a wicked fist. Such fasting as you do today will not make your voice heard on high. Is such the fast that I choose, a day to humble oneself? Is it to bow down the head like a bulrush and to lie in sackcloth and ashes? Will you call this a fast, a day acceptable to the Lord? And then this. Is not this the kind of fasting I have chosen? To loose the chains of injustice and untie the cords of the yoke. To set the oppressed free and to break every yoke. Is it not to share your food with the hungry and to provide the poor wanderer with shelter? When you see the naked, to clothe them. And not to turn away from your own flesh and blood. Then your light will break forth like the dawn and your healing will quickly appear. Then your righteousness will go before you, and the glory of the Lord will be your rear guard. Then you will call, and the Lord will answer. You will cry for help, and he will say, here am I. The Lord goes with us as we do justice. So Norman, I'd love to answer some of your questions about the work, about anything. How do we do it? Please come up with your trickiest questions. We're really... really keen to get the trickiest ones possible.
we've got some written ones, but if you'd like to also do it by hand, that's also possible.
Let you decipher if you can't read. I can.
I should have also mentioned that my connection to IJM, on a personal level, I'm actually on the board of the Australian Partner Office, and so we've been going through a process of establishing all of the corporate and other tax and existential organisational things in Australia recently. The organisation is quite advanced around the world, but we're kicking off here. So there's a few questions.
That's awesome. They're really good. Okay, I'm just going to take them one by one, is that right?
Why don't you do that? Yeah.
Okay. They're very field-based, so
okay, how do you start working in an Indian city? So, good question. We always have, when we go into a country, we speak with NGO partners and also with the government. So they know that we're there. They're open to partnering with us in some shape or form because they realise maybe we can help them out in some way to learn how to enforce their laws. And how do we start? Really, when we start, it's a real case-by-case situation. So, as I said, we do design projects that actually strengthen justice systems as a whole, and we've had amazing results, and I'll speak about that in a second. But the way we actually start is by doing the cases, because there's nothing like doing cases to establish credibility. As we, a lot of the time, in India, for example, it happens everywhere that we work, but in India, when we first went into India, and we said, look, there's all these cases of bonded labour. There's a law against bonded labour in India, rarely enforced. There are millions of places. Let's enforce it. We were laughed at. You're never going to get that law enforced. Even if you get that law enforced to the sense, you know, to believe that somebody actually might care about bonded labourers, you're never going to get them officially recognised and entitled to the official entitlements that they are under law in terms of rehabilitation benefits. We started doing the cases. And what it's really about is showing and proving that justice for the poor is possible. So our vision statement actually is to rescue thousands, protect millions, and prove that justice for the poor is possible. So what we do is we show them, we worked with you on this case, look at this amazing outcome. And when they see that, they start to change. And so I'll tie into another question. How do you know that law enforcement authorities are not corrupt and in league with the brothel owners? Well, they are often corrupt and in league with the brothel owners. So what we find is that there's a small chunk that are very corrupt, there's a small chunk that want to do good. This is in most countries. And then there's a big portion in the middle that just go with the flow and don't think it's really possible to change the system. And as we do the cases, that big chunk in the middle, they learn that it's possible and the tide starts to shift. So in terms of corruption, though, we deal with it on a case-by-case basis. We use various tactics in terms of complaints under other laws, going to higher officials. It's really about good relationships with the right authorities. An example in the Philippines is we had some officials who were not even so much in league with the owners of a very large establishment, but so scared of actually working against them that they might get transferred out of their own position to some far-flung regional, you know, destination if they actually came up against them. And what happened was we went to the Minister of Justice in the Philippines and they realised, you have amazing evidence on this case, this could look good for me to actually do something here. And she picked up the phone and she said to this official, do it, and if you have problems, send them to me, send your colleagues to me. And so that was all over the papers, and they get really good media coverage. And when they get good media coverage, they start to think this is a bit of all right, and the system starts to change. It changes so much so that when we first went into the Philippines in 2006, our aim after 4 years was to reduce the prevalence of sex trafficking children in our target area by 20%. At the end of 4 years, we found that it had reduced by 79%. Because it turns out that sex traffickers aren't brave. And when you start sending them to jail, they leave the children alone. And it has a much wider effect than the individual cases as well. How do the oppressed workers get in touch with us? Various methods. If they're extremely oppressed and unable to get out in those situations with no contact with the outside, we actually have investigators, and they're trained investigators, and they do undercover police type work to gather information, along with the police as well. So we always work in partnership. We don't want to be doing things on our own. It's not good for the system, and it's more dangerous as well. And so we work and we take them on our cases and mentor them on the way through. The other way is through in other types of cases. So we do slavery, sex trafficking, straight child sexual assault work, police brutality and property and land grabbing across the world. And in the different types of cases, they might refer through an NGO, through a friend, through a church. They all refer to us. Or just learn there's this place called IJM, and some of them might have access to or be able to get access to our information. This one's what difference can we really make? I hope that my example of those statistics in the Philippines showed you that we can really make a difference. 79% fewer minors being trafficked for sexual exploitation after 4 years. We can make a difference. Are your workers ever in real physical danger? Yes, when I was in India, actually two of our staff were taken hostage. That's one of the worst situations that we've had. Two things that it comes down to, three things. Professionalism. We have very skilled investigators and security professionals that have worked with military and law enforcement agencies designing our protocols and our systems and security measures, so professionalism. Secondly, it's who you know and how strategic you are. And so we're very sure to find out who are the people with the power to act and build good relationships with those people in their situations. And in this case, as soon as they were taken hostage, we called the highest police official we had a good relationship with, and he went in and he got them out. Because it usually happens at a sort of a local level that the violence is going to occur in relation to an operation or something like that. And as I said, we always go in with the police if we're conducting an operation. We don't go in alone. It's the police that are enforcing their own laws. We're there to advise and to ensure best practices in the operation. And then finally, prayer. There is probably no earthly reason why we've been protected the way we have in the 16 years that we've been working. And I just want to pay tribute to God, that a lot of it is the protection of God and the power of prayer. How does IJM interact, if at all, with the people doing the injustice and the oppression? We have partners with people like Prison Fellowship and other organisations that we, if someone is convicted and incarcerated, that, you know, we seek to ensure that, you know, they also have a connection with them. We pray for them. Most of the time we can't really have contact with them for the long time of the trial and the investigation. They're normally criminals and they're normally violent and they're normally annoyed that we are working on this case. So we don't have a lot of direct contact, as you can imagine, and particularly for the protection of the victims, who we have close contact with a lot of the time. What does the fact that IJM is a Christian organisation mean practically in the field offices, in working with local authorities and also churches? So all our staff are Christian, and I want to say this answers another question someone put through: how do people feel about, you know, white people telling, you know, foreigners what to do, how do they feel about it? It's not white people. 95% of IJM staff are nationals of the countries in which they work. I was one of two expat staff in the Chennai office at the time, and we have expat volunteers and fellows, but most of the time it's local lawyers and local investigators doing the actual interaction, and I was there to manage and train and capacity build. But these staff are all Christian. We consider ourselves a community of spiritual formation, and so we seek to obey Christ together. We have stillness, we have prayer together, we study the Bible together, we seek to encourage each other in our faith, and we take strength from that faith. Is actually the core of what we do, and it's not only inspiration, but it's the strength of what we do and how we move on in a place of darkness to keep our eyes fixed on Jesus. Practically also, though, we have church mobilisation departments in most of our field offices, which mean that they are actually engaging with local churches. They're teaching about biblical justice locally, and they're equipping churches locally to engage in justice ministry, either with IJM or with other organisations. So we have those strong relationships. In the Philippines, for example, we were party to, well, we actually initiated what's now called the Freedom Forum, which were the mainline denominations coming together and uniting to form a front against trafficking. So the Roman Catholics, the Presbyterians, and someone else. I wish I had Sam, who was here a couple of weeks ago from the Philippines, to tell me who they were, but they're all formed together to unite to provide a front against human trafficking and raise awareness. They have prayer forums where the churches come together and pray for this work. So we're mobilising the church, and that's also what we're doing in Australia as well. So we seek to mobilise the church here. We want to see the church become famous for its humble and courageous service to victims of violent injustice. We want to help churches become engaged in active and joyful and effective justice ministry and be a resource in terms of teaching. And we have many resources as well, and partnership as how churches might look at that and see how they will become engaged. Not just churches, Christians. So I'm here to mobilise people like yourselves who have skill, who might be considering why are we doing what we're doing, how can we lend our skill to something like this, and to recruit people with skill to the field in those capacity building roles, but also because we have year-long fellowship positions in the field, and we also eventually down the track will have teams that go across expert teams as well to be trained. I don't know if I've covered them all.
Any other questions?
Inspirational, and if you'd like to listen to that again, we recorded it. Assuming the recording worked, it'll be up on the website probably by the end of the week. So thank you very much, Amber and Norm, for arranging this. Next week, Ian has slipped me the secret bit of paper. I'll unfold it now, what is next week. And in true cryptic fashion, the three simplest and most profound words in the Bible, or ever written. We will seek to understand them and not drown in what they reveal. That's next week. And also next week, before you depart, can I draw your attention to All We Need Is Love? We're going to have a forum. This will be very exciting, very important topic to address. Wednesday and Thursday lunchtime. Is it loving to stop the boats? And you can read there the details of who the panellists are, coming from a cross-section of views and experiences. So come along for the forum at lunch if you can. Perhaps put this up on a notice board, hand it around the chambers or your office. And otherwise, we'll see you next week, Thursday morning.
The recording that you have just listened to is from the City Bible Forum. For more information about City Bible Forum events in your city, or to order other talks, please visit citybibleforum.org.